Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we're going in search of the taste of home. Since our country's founding, newcomers have brought their unique flavors of home with them. After all, food is one of the most accessible ways to learn about other cultures, and the place we can all come together is at the table. In researching her book, New Orleans' Best Ethnic Restaurants, Anne Benoit learned firsthand what it takes for immigrants to achieve the American dream. She'll tell us all about it. Then, we'll visit Fatma and Suleyman Aydin at their Turkish restaurant, Fetouche, to hear the story of their assimilation. And author Kim Suni explains how her life as an adopted Korean orphan inspired her to wander the world searching for her own personal taste of home, a story she chronicles in her new book, A Mouthful of Stars. Bring along your fork for a taste of the world on this week's Louisiana Eats. Author Kim Suni has insatiable appetites for travel, for knowledge, and especially for food. She's the author of the best-selling memoir, Trail of Crumbs, Hunger, Love, and the Search for Home. In her new book, A Mouthful of Stars, Kim continues her search for the flavors of home, and this time shares many favorite recipes discovered along the way.
You know, I think food chose me in a way, rather than, you know, me choosing food. But I think as a career, or more professionally, it didn't come until much later. For me, it was really poetry and language that I loved the most, and I wanted to be a poet. And of course, my family thought that was the most non-lucrative thing one could ever do. I was actually a writing student at NOCA. That was a difficult program back then. It was way up on Perrier when we had no air conditioning, first of all. And I actually, for some reason, thought I wanted to be a journalist, which had nothing to do really with the type of writing that I love to do. Writing is difficult, but I think I did it because it was a way to make sense of the world, or my world in particular. And I think because I was adopted and I don't really have any true records of who I am, that to actually put something in black and white in print, it gives me my own history and it gives me a definition, not the defining thing about myself. But writing in general is a way to sort of distill moments, good and bad, or happy and joyful. And so that's why I started writing. And then cooking came along with that, because maybe cooking is the joyful side of sometimes writing can be a little bit more melancholy.
So somehow you found your poetry in food?
I think so. And recipes are like poems to me. And I think that's why in this new book, A Mouthful of Stars, I wanted to include poetry.
Well, your new book begins with the story of your exploration of your biological heritage in Korea.
Yes.
How did that journey of discovery begin?
There was a Korean edition of my book, Trail of Crumbs, and the publisher invited me and I went back to Seoul. And I thought I was going there just to be an author and sign books and so forth. And once I got to Korea, there was this, just the media and publicity, and everyone all of a sudden decided they wanted to help me find my birth family. But I also met some other adoptees who were there. And so the journey turned very differently and unexpectedly. And it was pretty emotional.
There's a beautiful story about someone who thought maybe he was your brother.
Yes. I would get emails every once in a while from Koreans and saying, oh, I think you might be my daughter, or I think you might be my sister. And I don't know why, but I always ignored those. Not ignored them, but I didn't want to imagine that maybe, you know, it was real. And then this one particular man really pursued it, and then I didn't hear from him for a while. But when I was there, he found out I was there, and he contacted the producer who was doing a documentary at the time about my journey. And their story made me understand that, you know, I wasn't alone in this. They had lost their daughter and their sister when she was about 3 years old, about my age, in the same 1970s or so. And, you know, we did the whole DNA test. The whole that story's in the book. But I will remember that he came to the hotel the first time and brought a gift. And it was a beautiful Mont Blanc writing pen, because I am a writer. But he had the words "missing you" engraved on the pen. And then he said, you know, I know that all these years someone has been missing you. And so we ended up having this wonderful friendship, and the DNA tests came back, and it was, you know, they were inconclusive. And so I will have to go back. But he said, no matter what, we can choose family and we can choose home.
And sometimes, you know, those are the best family members, the ones you choose.
The ones we choose, exactly.
So you've been to Korea now multiple times. When you begin to eat Korean food for the first time, are there flavors that somehow trigger forgotten memories in your heart?
As a young child, after being adopted, you know, I didn't want cookies or brownies and chocolate and milk and so forth after school. I wanted a bowl of steamed rice with a little pat of butter for several years. And then as I grew older and saw the other kids eating, you know, American snacks, that's what I wanted. But so I think there's something about that that came with me and that's inside of me. And then going back to Korea, no matter how difficult it was to feel Korean again or to feel accepted back into the country, I immediately would taste something. And I didn't have all these memories rushing back, but I really felt comfortable eating this food. And it made me feel welcome and grounded.
Does this begin to inform your personal cooking?
A little bit. When I was in Korea, actually, I bought Korean English cookbooks, grandmother cookbooks, just to kind of see. And I actually took some classes while I was there. But it's not something that I can go to easily and make quickly. Like I can throw together a pasta or jambalaya, you know, something like that.
It's a lot more complicated.
It's complicated and it's more thoughtful. You have to really want to do it and think about it. More deliberate.
You mentioned earlier about your love for poetry. And I have, you know, followed your prose as you have written for periodicals, your work with Cottage Living, and you're renowned, award-winning for your prose. But I really didn't know about the poet in you. So in Mouth of Stars, there's a poem that really touched my heart. And I was wondering if I could get you to read whatever feels the best to you. And tell us a little bit about it.
So this poem, you'll find the poem at the end of the Korea section. And I was with a poet, Lee Herrick, who's a poet from California. He was also adopted from Korea.
And he took that trip with you.
He took that trip with me. We met there, actually. And so we went through this whole search for birth families and so forth. And I was thinking about, you know, you're always so conscious of what you're eating and what you're giving to someone else. And then I thought about what our birth mothers might have eaten and so forth and how that might have affected us. So I think that's what the poem is about. So it's in four sections. And the first one is called, "If I Am What I Eat, Then I Am the Raw Jellied Crab Oozing on the Tongue as We Sit in a Small Hot Room in Insadong, Where You, a man I have known my whole life, have come to take pause in the search of a birth mother. This is all we have, this crab, only this time of year, in this part of the world. Years ago, they warned eating it this way could cause temporary memory loss. But that smile on your face as you slurp the sea from one of the legs, and the heat of you, broad golden moon, eyes dark like hot stones. No one will ever know if those are tears or small birds in flight. Like the moments of our childhood, no one recorded, as if remembering would be too much. This temporary moment of forgetting is all we have, and somehow worth it all. 2. If you are what you eat, then you are the salted tomatoes and capers from climbing twisted vines in a town dusted with departure, and feverish kisses to the cheek, the neck, the underside of the palm, as a small boat awaits you. Let us share one last bowl of pasta, you suggest, with anchovy, hot pepper, a swipe of thick country bread drenched in bittersweet golden oil. If I am what you eat, I am the motherlode, the 200-year-old Istrian yeast for a biga, so sweet and swollen. A handful of golden raisins, saffron threads from a song I used to know by heart, a song I sing because I am what you are. If you are what I eat, then you will be a hot puffed donut filled with vanilla-flecked cream. I will be the moon rising and dusting the orchards with light and air, water and wind. Because if you are what I eat, then I will no longer eat fear, the way I used to, when I thought danger could slip into a bowl of noodles, like an unseen poison, like the hatred in countries, in the blackened hearts of people who know nothing of themselves. Because you are what I am, then I will be love and the memories of your childhood. And this is worth everything.
Oh, that is so beautiful. And I love the dichotomy between the two sides of that, because one seems to be clearly about your Eastern side and the other addresses the Western side of Kim Sinead.
I just realized that when I was reading it.
Well, I am so grateful that you stopped in New Orleans on your book tour.
Yay, I'm so happy to be home.
And that you decided to stop in and share Kim Sinead with my Louisiana Eats listening audience. So thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Poppy.
Kim Sinead, author of A Mouthful of Stars. Food isn't just a symbol of cultural identity. For the nonprofit organization Old Ways, honoring one's cultural food traditions also means eating healthier dishes than those usually found in American food. The mission of Old Ways is to help guide people to good health by having them take a closer look at their culinary heritage. Recently, the program was offered at New Orleans East Village Desjardins Senior Community Apartments. Dozens of residents eagerly attended every week, and after class, everybody sat down together to enjoy a healthy meal. Our sound engineer, Joe Schreiner, sent in this postcard.
So, did anybody complete their homework?
No.
Did anybody try a new whole grain that they've never tried before? You can just raise your hand.
I am Alicia Butte, and I'm one of the Old Ways instructors here in New Orleans.
And I'm Phyllis Boudreaux, and I'm one of the Old Ways presenters also.
Today we are at Village Desjardins here in New Orleans East.
Well, this week we're going to totally switch it up.
Okay.
You're talking about tubers and mashes. Who knows what a tuber is?
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. Is that the only kind of tuber?
Old Ways was started in 1990 to kind of combat all the chronic diseases that are on the rise, like diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. So we are starting this movement of teaching people how to eat plant-based, healthy foods that are based on the African heritage in an effort to kind of inspire this lifestyle change.
All right, good afternoon, everyone.
Hi, Alicia.
How are you guys? Okay. I'm going to start off with a question. How many of us are kind of hesitant to try something new because we aren't sure how to prepare it? You know, we've seen the taro, we've seen all these different tubers that we may have never had. Well, we're providing you with a chart of some preparation tips.
Okay. We spoke with the manager, and we found out that they would welcome a program like this for the residents. So So we started the program actually 5 weeks ago. It's a 6-week program. We've had participants who are not just named participants. They actually participate in everything we do here. They appreciate us being here and the fact that they can live healthier. Okay, dishes we're going to have today. Senegalese sweet potato peanut stew. Woo! Come on, y'all know y'all want to
spread. My name is Tony Hatcher. I stay in Building 16. To me, it's like spinach and potatoes. It look like spinach and squash and stuff like that. That's what it looked like to me. But it's healthy. What it is, it's a light food. It's not like something heavy on your stomach. It's about teaching us how to eat healthy. Everybody's supposed to eat healthy. But like when you get at that certain age level, you got to really take care of yourself because, you know, when you get around into your 50s and 60s, you're dealing with high blood pressure, diabetic, you know, and stuff like that. And then you got to watch how to eat.
Greens and corn is pretty good.
It tastes good, man.
It's kind of spicy.
I can't eat nothing spicy.
Young lady, yeah. This tastes good.
Good. Why'd you like
you
it?
Cooked that?
Nope.
Okay.
That was Miss Phyllis
back. Okay.
But it's just.
I enjoy it because it's something dealing with your health. You know, it's and the teachers and the ladies who comes there, and I appreciate them to the highest, you know, for their effort. And I thank them so much. Always got to eat healthy, you know. When you eat healthy, you feel healthy. Your mind is strong, you know. And that's what it's all about.
Turkish-born Suleiman and Fatma Aydin are living the American dream. When we come back, they'll tell the story of what it took to achieve that goal. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. For food writer Scott Gold, fried food in his native New Orleans is a great source of pride. Scott pays tribute to his hometown with this anecdote of how a kitchen in the Lower Garden District responded to one visitor's aggravating request in true Big Easy style.
Perfectly fried food is art, and art must be respected, if not revered. Which is why I got a bit nervous recently on an outing to the Irish House restaurant on St. Charles Avenue. I was having a couple of pints with some old high school friends, happy to catch up on new times and reminisce about the old ones, when, of course, we started to get a little hungry. Without even looking at the menu, my friend John asked the bartender if they served Scotch eggs. I don't think so, she replied hesitantly, but I can ask the chef. Okay, said John. If he can do it, we'll take 6 of them. Now, if you didn't know, a Scotch egg is a treat in the United Kingdom traditionally served at picnics and similar festive events, and at pubs much like the Irish House. Quite simply, it is a hard or softly boiled egg packed into a loose sausage mixture, breaded, battered, and deep fried. Sure, we love our fried foods, our pork, and our eggs in this country. And this is all of them in one supercharged, crunchy, creamy, eggy, fist-sized package with enough fat and cholesterol to make your cardiologist wet himself. Naturally, it's just as good as it sounds. Part of me was excited when John asked the bartender about Scotch eggs. It's not a particularly commonplace dish in these parts, and on top of that, it requires a significant amount of skill and time to carry off properly, even if you happen to have all the ingredients on hand. Not to mention that it wasn't even on the menu, and 6 of them! Having spent my tour of duty in the service industry, I've seen trained, professional chefs scream bloody murder and threaten to fillet patrons with a boning knife for asking less. It would be one thing if the chef was John's buddy, but my friend hadn't stepped a foot in the Irish House in his life. Nonetheless, he remained undaunted. 45 minutes later, the three of us retreated to 6 of the most beautiful, perfectly executed Scotch eggs I've ever tasted. Not only did he take our off-the-menu request and knock it into the cheap seats, he elegantly plated each dish with a dollop of Creole mustard and a simple green salad. Now, I would never in good conscience suggest that you demand off-the-menu items at any restaurant, especially ones in which you've never dined before. It's a bold move, one that in most circumstances will only win you a healthy amount of scorn from the servers and kitchen staff. Still, every now and again these things just kind of work out for the best, and I'm willing to guess that they do so more here than in other places. That seems to be the way of things down here, doesn't it?
That was food writer Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. I said this is my city, my hometown, they ain't representing, so I gotta hold it down. Said this is my city, my hometown, they ain't representing, so I gotta hold it down now. Since there are over 400 ethnic restaurants in the Crescent City, it took Anne Benoit years to research and write New Orleans' best ethnic restaurants. Even though the families she met came from different parts of the world, Anne observed that each generation shares certain characteristics.
As I worked with the people in the restaurants, I kind of noticed groupings. The first one I call the Old Worlders. They were born in the old country. They spent most of their life in the old country. They've come here because of some tragic thing that's happening in their country. They speak primarily the language of the old country. They're cooking for members of that expat community and for their family. They're not really cooking for New Orleanians at large. They're trying to bring the comfort of a taste of home to their community. They want to return to the old country, or they want to return a higher economic status, or they want to return their country to the way it was. They want to recover the lost home, whatever it is. The next group, slightly younger, and I call them the Brave New Worlders.
Uh-huh.
They were born in the old country and may have spent a small amount of their adult years, but they've come to this country and are spending the vast amount of their adult years here. They are actively trying to learn this culture. They are actively trying to learn this language. They're here because they want to be here. Their home is this world. They believe that they can accomplish anything, and because they believe that they can accomplish anything, they do. The next group is the biculturals, and the biculturals are the children of those first two groups. They live with a foot in each world.
Mm-hmm.
They're bilingual. They're bicultural. They may have been born in the old country, but they've grown up here. They live in one culture in school and another culture at home, and they very fluidly move back and forth between cultures. They serve as interpreters for their parents and for their grandparents, and interpreters not only of language but also of culture. They have a tendency to be, unfortunately, in conflict with their parents because they're exposed to two sets of values, and they're always trying to move those two sets of values together. And they help their family to move forward in the restaurant business. And then the last group I called the Romantic Retros. They are the children of the biculturals. Their knowledge of the old country is very rosy and filtered through the only good memories told them by their grandparents. They speak the language here. They might know one or two words, which are maybe terms of endearment that their grandparents used to call them. They're very interested in their culture, but this is their home, and there's no question about it. They pick and choose from the old culture what they're going to keep and what they're not. So, example, they might collect the old world art or music, but when it comes to arranged marriages and chaperones on dates, maybe not. So those are like the groups that I saw as I would go into a restaurant. And it's amazing to watch how they all help each other in the restaurant business.
Anne Benoit, author of New Orleans' Best Ethnic Restaurants. Brave new worlders can accomplish anything, according to Anne Benoit. Suleiman Aden agrees.
Generally, foreigners, when they come in America, they have a goal. They come for something. They come here to make it, send money back home, take care of the family. So that makes them more better workers. They're more opportunistic. If they see something, that they really jump on it. And once an American is like, I don't know, my finance, I don't know, this and that, I don't know, I can do it. That doesn't almost not exist in the foreigners, you know. They were like, okay, this is my chance. I'm going to take this chance. That's what I'm here for. So they take a chance. Sometimes they fail, generally, but if you're working so hard, so you're going to make it. So once you have that goal, is all you got to do, be a little smart and hardworking, and you make it. For example, if you are American and live in my country, yes, you probably just like me, I'm here, you know, because you're in a foreign country, so you have to make it because that's their country. They know everything. For them is they have security, they have their parents, they have their grandparents. They feel secure, but you're by yourself. So you have to be sure that you take care of yourself and who else with you. So I think it's being a foreigner in another country always make you better workers and more opportunistic. I mean, I had my first bicycle, my first car, my first own apartment, my first soccer shoes. Even it was all in America. Everything I own my own is happened in America.
In 1984, Suleiman was a merchant marine in the Turkish fleet when he first landed in Louisiana. The vessel docked in New Orleans, where he was seduced by the city, so he grabbed his bags and jumped ship. His first job was as dishwasher, but Suleiman eventually became owner and manager of his own restaurant, Mona Lisa. Mona Lisa provided a good life for Suleiman's family, including his sister Fatma, who joined him here 2 years later.
When you first arrive, it's an amazing culture shock. He came and picked me up from airport and then took me to this Jean Paul's French party at their home. I thought, I'm in hell.
Oh,
like, this is a hell. I can't stay here. I cried and cried. It was horrible. People were drunk and partying hard, and it was I never had a drink in my life before. I was 23 years old, never had a drink in my life. All of a sudden I'm in this party, everybody's wild, crazy, drinking loud. I was just in one corner. I'm like, that's it, this is the hell. I have to find a way to get out of here. And then cried and cried and cried. I called my mom, like, I gotta go back, I can't stay here. So, and then Suleiman said, this is not the everyday thing. This is just a party. I'm like, what party? When I started school, the teacher said, the best way to learn English, you have to get a job somewhere that only English-speaking people. Otherwise, you learn on the book, but you won't be able to speak. So I got a job at Crazy Corner Nightclub.
Oh,
on
my
Bourbon
goodness.
Street. Loud, live music, and me don't know nothing about the alcohol, neither the name of the alcohols.
What was your job there?
Cocktail waitress. And then one day, this man, as a tip, he put his hand in his pocket and pulled out a handful of a green grass-looking something and put on my tip tray. And I looked at it. I was so mad at the man that I thought it was so rude that he gave me dry grass for tip. So there was a big jukebox. I went in there and I dumped my tray on the jukebox, cleaned my tray, and I'm just, you know, working around. All the employees surround the jukebox doing some stuff. I'm like, what is going on? I go in there. They are splitting my dry grass things that I throw it in there. I go, my God, what is this? You want some? I'm like, no. So a rude man gave me those. They're like, oh, and you don't want it? I'm like, no, what am I going to do with the dry grass? They're like, you smoke. And I'm like, no, I don't smoke. I thought it was the... I never seen a marijuana in my life before. It was the first time I met marijuana.
Fatma and Suleiman worked alongside each other at Mona Lisa for years, eventually growing their operation to include 7 different restaurants, where they learned the business from the ground up.
I never cooked in my life in Turkey. None of us cooked, not much, because the mom was a housewife, so she did all the cooking for her house. And only relation we had with the restaurant was our dad worked in a restaurant as a waiter for 40, 45 years. So, but after we moved here, he opened some small restaurant. Then he ran that one for 5 years. But other than that, we didn't have much of cooking experience or restaurant experience at all. It's all happened in America.
The reason for that is, in Turkey, it doesn't matter how old you are. As long as you are single, you live with your parents. You have no choice. When you live with your parents, your mom don't work, so she's the housewife, and girls work with the mom in the kitchen and cooks. So boys do not cook at all. So I was cooking with my mother. I learned how to cook a little, but never for commercially. Even if our dad owned restaurants, he never asked us to go work in his restaurant. I have never been into his restaurant's kitchen at all. So we only go there and eat and leave. Just cooking is in the Turkish family's home. That's women's job, and women learn how to cook, should learn how to cook. So men don't do that.
Eventually, the siblings opened Cafe Istanbul on Frenchman Street and then orchestrated its move to the Healing Center on St. Claude Avenue. In the new facility, they opened Fatouche, a family-operated Middle Eastern restaurant. They believe their success could have only happened here in America.
Well, I was merchant marine. She was working in a bank. I don't want to work in a bank or office and anything like that. That's not my type. I need to move. You know, if I don't move, I'm bored. I can't make it without moving. I probably was still working in a merchant marine. She probably was already retired from the bank.
I would be probably a miserable banker because my father put me into the bank. He chose what I need to do. He said, the lady has to work in the bank. You are a girl, and girly thing to do is work in the bank. He got me the job. And then what you have to do is get married, have children, and then this is not none of them that I wanted to do at all. So I probably will have 4 or 5 children and retire from bank, and then non-happy one housewife probably then after that. You know, I didn't want to do those. I had to run out of there so quick.
So now you're in the business of happiness here in New Orleans.
So here I choose to do, and I live the life that I want to live. I choose the things that I want to do. Over there, I wouldn't be doing that. I had to do what my father wanted me to do, or what my family or relatives, where you live, they do watch what you do. You have to watch everybody, what they will think. Uh-huh. So here.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Freedom. America, freedom. Not really. You really find out what's the freedom in America. Your rights are protected. And as a citizen, you can defend yourself against government or against whatever. But in back home, you can't almost. You're not allowed to defend yourself. I can't imagine living in Turkey, you know. I'd like to go back when I retire, but I will never work and anything like that. But I just can't imagine and be able to work in Turkey. You know, rise very fast, swear at everybody in the city hall, including mayors and da-na-na. You know, I lose my tempers. If you do that in Turkey, you spend some time in jail. You know? And definitely. But here, this is your right. They piss you off, you have a right to express yourself, you know? We did well in New Orleans. Yeah. Not bad at all.
It's our home.
That restaurant took care of every one of us. So it was good. No complaining.
That was Suleiman and Fatma Aydin, siblings, owners and managers of Fatouche Restaurant and Coffee Bar. What are those delicious tiny oval nuts often used in Middle Eastern food? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers.
Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What are those delicious tiny oval nuts often used in Middle Eastern food? They're pine nuts. Edible pine tree seeds harvested from about 20 different species of pines found across the world. Unfortunately, our Louisiana pines are not among the varieties that produce an edible seed. It's the stone pine, which grows all across the Mediterranean and the Middle East, that are responsible for yielding the large quantities of nuts needed in everything from kibbeh to baklava. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. In the hot, steamy summers of July in New Orleans, Tales of the Cocktail brings together cocktail professionals and enthusiasts from all over the world. For some, Tales of the Cocktail is the place where they find the love of their life. Jamie Evans and Chelsea Pico are one of those couples, but suffice it to say, it wasn't love at first sight.
I initially had met Jamie, my fiancé, through a mutual friend of ours, and we happened to run into him, or should I say stumble into him, right outside of old Abson's house. You know, I was less than impressed. But then his persistence and his charm and his overwhelming personality just ended up getting the best of me, and I finally let him take me out on a date in New York, and then on to Tales a couple of years later.
Where Jamie had plans. Big plans. He had to lead a seminar and decided to take advantage of his moment in the spotlight.
The seminar was fantastic. It overran slightly, but I still took time to ensure that I thanked everybody in the room for coming. I thanked the panelists for being there. And then I turned to Chelsea and I said, if you guys don't mind, there's one last person that I really need to thank. I looked at her and she looked back at me with this incredibly evil death stare. And I read in a split second the translation being, don't you dare make me stand in front of all these people. So she came up, wasn't particularly happy with me at the time. And then I finally said to her, you know, I know that you have an adoration of diamonds. Unfortunately, I don't have one big one for you. Put my hand in my pocket, drew out this bracelet with the diamonds, got down on one knee, looked her in the eye and said, Chelsea, I would really love it if you would agree to marrying me. She looked at me, her cheeks immediately flushed. She grabbed me and, it was at least another day, I think, before she said yes. She maintains that she said yes instantly, but all I understood was, it was an obvious yes, even though the words weren't uttered from her mouth.
Since the proposal, Jamie's delivered that traditional sparkly diamond ring.
We had talked about marriage, but I definitely wasn't expecting it to come right then and there. You know, Tales of the Cocktail has always been a really fun, exciting event to look forward to every year. Now it's just been taken to a whole nother level, and it's an absolute must that Jamie and I will be there every year, and we look forward to celebrating not only Tales of the Cocktail, but our engagement every year.
Have you made a love connection at Tales of the Cocktail? Our friends at Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe want to hear your story of love at Tales. Submit your tale to love@palacecafe.com by Wednesday, July 9th. One lucky winner will receive a romantic dinner for two at the Palace Cafe and a surprise gift from Tales of the Cocktail.
My first, my last, my everything. And the answer to all my dreams. You're my sun, my moon, my guiding star, my kind of wonderful. That's what you are.
Husband and wife writing team Paul and Angela Knippel believe that you can discover the whole world in a southern black iron skillet. Interviewing more than 40 first-generation immigrants who now call the South home, they're here to invite us along on an international culinary journey that never crosses north of the Mason-Dixon line. Paul and Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Poppy.
So how did you all come to write this book?
There's a wonderful Mexican restaurant in Germantown, which is a suburb of Memphis. And the owner, when the business first opened, before it got so crazy busy, if he didn't recognize a customer, he would ask, have you eaten with us before? And if they said no, they would not eat there until they heard his story. And he serves very traditional Mexico City-style street food, no Tex-Mex, you know, no refried beans, no sour cream. And he also told them about why the quality of the food is so important and why they shop every single day for fresh produce. First time we went there, we heard the story. Eating there afterwards, we heard other people hear the story many times. One day, we just heard someone get asked that question, and we looked at each other and said, we should write a book about this.
Now tell me, what are the countries represented in World in a Skillet, and which states did you cover?
We covered everything that would be considered the South. We didn't make it to Texas or Florida because they're just so large and their cultures are so great, their books in and of themselves. We did the coast, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Arkansas.
I'm curious, which southern city did you find to be the most international?
Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Atlanta was very hard to narrow down. Of course, one of the things we really had to do was make sure we weren't making a favorite of any particular city, that the book wasn't going to be overpopulated by any one city. And Atlanta was very hard to narrow down because there's this one strip called Buford Highway in Atlanta. And on that one highway, you find this huge international representation. And it's not like anywhere else that I've ever seen. Normally, immigrants cluster and you'll have a Vietnamese area or a Chinese area or an African area. But on Buford Highway, you'll see an Ethiopian restaurant next to a Korean restaurant, next to a Chinese restaurant, next to a Mexican restaurant, next to a deli from the Middle East. And they're all right there together on this miles-long stretch of highway. And it's just amazing. It's a fun, fun place to go.
Well, I know several of your contributors can be found right here in New Orleans. Let's talk about them.
Yes.
New Orleans was our second biggest city that we had the problem with trying to narrow down. We talked to two gentlemen from Central and South America. One is Manny Ochoa Galvez, who owns Macarena Pupuseria, which is very close to Camellia Grill, right around the corner.
Yeah.
Wonderful place. Wonderful man. He's just got such a tremendous personality. We also talked to Edgar Caro, who owns Baru Bistro on Magazine. And the key word for both of them was grandma, because Manny talked about his grandma, who is still living in El Salvador, and she still gathers ingredients, you know, dries them, makes their spices, grinds them, and ships them here. And Edgar's grandmother lives here, but, you know, as he was learning to cook as a younger man, and even now in the restaurant, he says, if my grandmother doesn't complain, I know I've done it right.
We wanted to talk to people that anyone else would want to sit down and have dinner with. And Father Vian, you could sit down and talk to him all day and never get bored.
True. He was the pastor at yes. Mary Queen of Vietnam, and he's still here working in the Archdiocese.
Yes. Yes. He just has such amazing goals for his community and what he wants to see happen here. And just hearing his story about how the community pulled back together after Katrina and what they did to work together and make it just a wonderful community was just amazing for us.
How is the South's immigrant culinary culture expanding the definition of Southern food?
It's so great. Maria Macreso in Bardstown, Kentucky, is a Bosnian refugee. And one thing that's really great is seeing Southern cuisine influencing her, because the best derby pie in town is made by this Bosnian refugee. She owned a restaurant in Bosnia and, of course, had to flee and come here. But now she's being influenced by the South. But we've also seen influences going the other way.
Catfish sushi. a place called Little Tokyo in Ridgeland, Mississippi. Their original location was in downtown Jackson. I think it's still there.
Yep.
When they first moved there, they were the first Japanese restaurant to open in Jackson, Mississippi. And one of the things they served to try to get people who'd never tried sushi before was fried catfish wrapped in sushi roll.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And instead of soy, of course, you can also have the soy, but instead of soy, it also comes with a small little bowl of comeback sauce, which, you know, is the remoulade of Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, did you see any cases of surprising substitutions that immigrants were making for things that they couldn't source?
Not really. I mean, I think that's one thing that the South has really opened up with commerce. You find international markets in almost every major city. People are able to bring in things that they couldn't before. And then just like here in New Orleans, you see immigrants growing gardens, like the Vietnamese community has their huge gardens where they're growing their own produce. So we really don't see that many ingredient substitutions because people are able to get most of what they need.
Or they'll grow it themselves,
exactly.
I guess.
Yes.
Well, the South has had a reputation of being reluctant to change. And it also has Southern hospitality going on. So how did you all see that factor into the immigrant experience?
I don't think we talked to a single person who said they felt unwelcome. We did have a couple of people who worried when we first started talking to them that we might be from immigration.
Oh.
We had to reassure them that, no, we're not from immigration. We just want to talk to you. But no one ever said they felt unwelcome in their community.
The most difficult thing, though, was for some of the Muslim immigrants. One of the gentlemen from our Kurdish chapter, Rauf Ari, was an electrician in Iraq. Of course, fled Iraq, during the war, and came here and was working here as an electrician in Nashville. And after 9/11, everyone in his company knew he was a Muslim, and everyone started putting a lot of pressure on him. Why did this happen? Osama bin Laden. Why, a lot of ridiculous prejudice that he did face. So he went to his management and said, I can't take this. Can you please just lay me off? I'm going to move on. So he invested in a grocery store, a small market, and has made a big success out of that.
Well, I just want to thank you all so much for telling us all of these beautiful tales and the wonderful way you stirred it together in that skillet. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Poppy.
Paul and Angela Knippel, co-authors of The World in a Skillet.
Southbound again. Don't know if I'm going to leave and home. Southbound again. Don't know if I'm going to leave and home.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next time for the inspiring story of Chris and Summer Wadsworth and their new project in Baton Rouge, Triumph Kitchen.
I literally came home and told her I was done.
Yeah.
I said, I can't do the 80 hours. I want to take a break right now from this industry of just go, 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 go. And I can tell you, yeah, 2013 was big, but at the end of the day, Summer and I were trying to find a way to blend our two passions together. And this was the best fit for that.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima and Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.